I'm Sybil Goldstein, and I'm the visual arts coordinator for Ashkenaz. This event tonight is a sort of a bit of a kickoff for the visual arts at the festival. We're very fortunate to have with us three of the artists who are exhibiting at the festival. Unfortunately, you won't be able to see your fair work until tomorrow at the opening for Dancing with the Leviathan. The show opens next door at the York Sea Gallery, 5:30 to 7:30. And runs until October 13th. The subject of tonight's panel, The Artist is Jew, The Jew is Artist, which catchy title that it is, addresses some of the issues that our artists are working with around cultural identity, personal identity, and contemporary Jewish visual culture. We're fortunate this panel, this idea, and this forum was put together by Sylvia Patak, our moderator for this evening. She's an artist in her own right, has recently put together a resource board for the North York region on Holocaust artists, and will be teaching a course upcoming at the Bloor JCC on Jewish visual culture. So without further ado, I'll pass you over to Sylvia, who will introduce the artist to you.
Participating artists are Ron Singer, Cyril Reed, and Jeff Gordon Mark. Howard Kadeff, unfortunately, is unavailable to be with us. I'm going to give a brief introduction of the panelists. Each artist will have an opportunity to present their viewpoints and personal perspectives, after which questions, comments, and a lively interactive discussion between the audience and artists will ensue on the floor. Now, some of the issues that I have suggested to the artists to think about while planning their presentation are these. In the process of art making, how do you identify yourself? As a Jewish artist? As an artist dealing with Jewish issues? Is there a difference? Does one influence or inform the other? When the content of your work is not specifically Jewish, does your cultural heritage inform the work? Can it play? Can it be otherwise? In conceiving and executing the work for the Ashkenaz Festival, what were the issues you were dealing with, and how did the piece develop? I'll introduce the artists in the order in which they will speak. Yvonne Singer is an installation artist. She teaches fine arts and education department at York University. She has upcoming shows in Italy, Germany, and Montreal. Her work in the Ashkenaz Festival, entitled A Portable Viewing Station for Anxious Travelers, is in the York Key Gallery at Harborfront, and the opening is tomorrow, August 28th, between 5:30 and 7:30 p.m. Cyril Reed has done many outdoor installation pieces, which are left to weather over time. One such work is Minion, a Holocaust memorial installed at the Bathurst Jewish Center in 1995. He has taught at various academic institutions in Canada. Recently, he's been exploring and researching issues of Jewish culture, and he will be teaching, he and I will be offering the course at the Jewish, on Jewish visual culture at the Bloor Community Center. His work in the Ashkenaz Festival is entitled All New, German for Old and New, and it's installed underneath the bridge. Bora Newmark initiated the symposium, Visual Art and Jewish Identity, a Contemporary Experience, under the auspices of the Sadie Bronson Center for the Arts, held in Montreal in 1994. She's active as a volunteer and on the board of Auberge Shalom, a kosher women's shelter and resource center for abused women and their dependent children in Montreal. Her work is interdisciplinary and encompasses bookwork, street intervention, as well as photography. In September, Bora will be participating in a street intervention in Montreal, where she will be crocheting on the street for 400 hours. Her work in the Ashkenaz Festival entitled A Truth, A Fiction, A Shabbos Clothes and Feeling an Imposter opens tomorrow, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at York Sea Gallery of Harborfront.
So here,
artist as Jew, Jew as artist. Can these categories be separated? How or why is it usually to do so? Can you provide someone's tradition?
A question. Question. It's, the mic's on and off. Is it on now? Yes. Now it's off? Is it on? Okay. Why don't I start again? So in true Talmudic tradition, I'm going to answer a question with many questions. Artist as Jew, Jew as artist. Can these categories be separated? How or why is it useful to do so? At first glance, these two descriptions appear to be obvious and clear-cut. But, in fact, the pairing of these labels allude to complex relationships, historical and social circumstances, and in the end, evoke more questions than answers. Do Jewish artists make Jewish art? Can non-Jews make Jewish art? Is there something I said? Okay, try again. So, do Jewish artists make Jewish art? Can non-Jewish artists make Jewish art? What does it mean to be Jewish? What does it mean to be an artist? And what category of art practice? Contemporary, traditional, whatever. What about gender? What does it mean to be a woman artist or a woman artist as Jew or a Jewish woman as artist? What does it mean to be too Jewish or not Jewish enough? Too Jewish, Challenging Traditional Identities is the title of a recent exhibition at the Jewish Museum in New York. It is a provocative but intriguing title which triggers many thoughts for me. For example, do I want to be identified as a Jewish artist? And what relevance does my Jewishness have to my art practice? The painter Georgia O'Keeffe was adamant that she was an artist first and foremost, and that her gender was irrelevant. So to begin, I am drawing from my personal experience to create a context for investigating the complex relationship of identity to art practice. I grew up and lived in predominantly English and Jewish neighborhoods of Montreal, in a city where schools were divided by the category English Protestant or French Catholic, and in a household that was allergic to certain labels in their zeal to erase their own differences and to assimilate. Therefore, Canadian was a good label. International citizen of the world was a good label. While strong nationalist sentiments were bad, immigrant was a derogatory term. My family were immigrants to Canada from Hungary. My parents to this day retain their distinctive Hungarian accent, which still makes my mother self-conscious and apologetic about the way she speaks. I was born in Budapest at a turbulent historical moment, a moment when the Nazis, knowing that they were losing the war, pushed hard to eliminate the remaining Jews in Hungary. At the same time, the Russians were besieging the city. And at the age of 6, I arrived in Montreal, where I learned to speak English. My sensitivity to discrimination and injustice was finally honed. And when I was 12 years old, I wrote an impassioned speech advocating equality for immigrants, in which I paraphrased Shylock's speech, "Half not a Jew, and instead I substitute as half not an immigrant, eyes like you, etc." I was raised as a Protestant, but lived always in predominantly Jewish areas, where I experienced reverse prejudice from the neighborhood children and their parents. At the age of 21, I learned about my hidden Jewish identity only after I had converted to Judaism to marry in Quebec at a time when no civil ceremonies were available. Issues of identity: who am I, where do I belong, and the intersection of public and private histories have always informed my work, sometimes more overtly than at other times? Is my personal history responsible for this interest? Are there conditions of being uprooted and alienated? Are these conditions of being uprooted and alienated that made me an artist? Have I been influenced by the assimilationist attitudes of my parents? Janet Wolfe, the writer, says in her book, Alien Stranger, quote, "There is a new romanticism of exile at play today. Nobody wants to be identified with the center, that oppressive, dominant, static position," unquote. And she suggests that in the modern world, where many people are migrants and come from somewhere else, that we are all strangers. Does this mean that I finally belong to a category of people who don't belong anywhere? It reminds me of the Woody Allen line about, "I don't want to be a member of the club, any club that wants me as a member." We all carry many identities which we discard like snakeskins or accumulate in different circumstances. I am an immigrant, female, Jewish, a mother, daughter, sister, wife, teacher, sculptor, installation artist, Canadian, Hungarian, Torontonian, left-handed, farsighted with stigmatism, and so on. Where does one identity end and another begin? How does being a woman and or Jewish influence my art practice? It is hard to say. Our current understanding of the relationship between the self and the social suggests that idea is an unstable construct or condition. Anne Middleton Wagner, an art historian, writing about the artists Eva Hess, Lee Krasner, and Georgia Fee, and the relationship of their lives and being women to their work, puts it this way. Quote, "Femininity, and we could substitute or add Jewishness here, can be assigned as much as claimed, avoided as much as celebrated, with an act of negation potentially as eloquent as affirmation. Or can an individual's relation to feminine gender," and again we can substitute or add Jewishness, "an individual's relation to feminine gender and Jewishness may definitely escape her control," unquote. Being a woman or being Jewish is not the same as exemplifying womanliness or Jewishness, or evidencing special characteristics of being a woman or a Jew. At the same time, there is no question that my gender, my social class, religious and cultural background have contributed to my identity and have contributed to my identity and my interests as an artist. I think that the difficulty lies in the area of interpretation. In other words, trying to explain or understand how these factors contribute to the understanding of a work of art. Another version of this question is, do you need to know the biography of the artist in order to understand the art? In Memoriam, Forgetting and Remembering Fragments of History, was an exhibition that I did at the Fosler Gallery in 1993. I used the true story of Raoul Wallenberg, a Swedish diplomat who saved thousands of Jews in Budapest, was arrested by the Russians, and had disappeared in the Russian Gulag system, as a metaphor for dislocation, identity, and as an example of the intersection between history, in this case the Holocaust, and individual lives. Art making is about transformation. I use my own biography and connection to the story as a starting point and as a reference. The form of the work, the materials I use, the aesthetic choices I made were premised on many factors, often based on the demands of the materials and the media that I selected. as the aesthetic choices I made were also influenced by the training I have had as a contemporary conceptual artist, as well as by the work of other artists with quite eclectic backgrounds. It was important to me that the work resonate with a wider audience than a Jewish audience alone. I didn't want it to be ghettoized that is seen or understood only by Jewish viewers. The work in this current exhibition, A Portable Viewing Station for Anxious Travelers, is also a work about dislocation, shifting geographic, historical, and personal boundaries. It was conceived for an exhibition titled Historie e Storia, History and Other Stories, in Italy. And the site was a house in Villa Franca di Verona, where Napoleon signed a treaty with Austria and France to divide Italy. The viewing station is intended to function like a prosthesis, a body extension, and a home away from home. Like a suitcase with a suitcase on wheels, but for your whole body and mind, a traveler's aid. It is on wheels for added mobility. The rear view mirrors on either side enable you, the traveler, to see where you are coming from. The Fresnel lens magnifies in great detail where you are going to. And the piece presents the viewer with a somewhat enigmatic, paradoxical situation and as well as clues. Who are the anxious travelers that the title refers to, and why are they anxious? Both the mirrors and the Fresnel lens offer only partial perspectives on the past, present, and future. The initials on the suitcase suggest an identity, but there is an absence of a body here. The postcards also suggest the existence of someone. Who is the sender, and who is the receiver of these cards? The images on the postcards are idealized versions of people and places. What is real and what is imagined in this situation? The suitcase is my own initial overnight case, containing a collection of postcards with exotic images of far-flung exotic places, in addition to language dictionaries in French, English, Italian, German, and Hungarian. These languages represent the cultures and countries whose histories were implicated in this region in Italy and in Napoleon's exploits. They also reference my own origins within that Austro-Hungarian empire. Presence and absence, people and places that are revealed and concealed. Edward Said, a Palestinian writer, writes, he has written a lot about the state of exile and claims that one of the few benefits to the condition of exile is a certain originality of vision, which is the product of seeing the entire world as a foreign land. Can we claim this condition for the Jewish artist? Certainly for me, it is a familiar state of being, and in my work, I will continue to explore the shifting boundaries of this territory in my quest to understand it better, and in my quest for identity. In conclusion, I offer my story as a kind of case history, or one perspective on artists as Jew or artist, with no definitive answers or conclusions, and with the knowledge that my ideas, work, and the conditions of my identity are not static and are in constant flux. Thank you.
Thank you. work, like the research that I did around my work, I believe that I addressed the question in an artist's way of allowing myself poetic license on addressing the topic. The work, for those who haven't seen it and who can't see it, have difficulty finding it, as it's sort of suspended from the bridge, which is over that side. And it's made up of a number of pieces of that refer to synagogues that, for the most book part, I'll describe in this piece. A little over a year ago, I began a drawing project of the manufacturing building in the Garment District of Toronto. As I wandered around the neighborhood, I noticed how singular the still active Unchained Synagogue is within the context of the late Victorian architecture to be found in and around Kensington Market. And the former Beth Jacob on Andrew Street, the Feast of Beverly, logistically crowned its site with this particular architecture. Beth Jacob is now a Greek Orthodox house of worship, vacated when the Jewish community moved northward from the Spadina neighborhood. These buildings led me to trace their architectural origin and the traditions which spawned them. I found a style with many local variants, loosely covered by the term Moorish Revival, characterizing synagogues in Western and Central Europe and North America from the middle of the 19th century to the 1930s. Many of these synagogues were destroyed or are no longer used by the communities that built them. I recognize that this type of synagogue would have been similar to the ones which my grandparents, or more probably my great-grandparents, would have attended either here in Canada or in their European homeland. I know very little about my grandparents' arrival in Canada, despite frequent discussions with their descendants. I know my great-grandparents only through occasional references to them in conversation or through their being identified in family photographs. Exploring this time period allows me a glimpse into the communal lives of my grandparents and those of their parents. I admit to a certain nostalgia and to being enamored with the beauty and exoticism of the synagogue I'm experiencing. This search opens onto aspects of the social histories that I have yet to exhaust of the European and North American diaspora. And while this still incomplete knowledge is not personalized in that I have not traced my family's roots, the prevailing social and political conditions which I uncovered have begun to fill in many of the gaps in what I know about the lives of my grandparents and great-grandparents. It helped me trace many of the attitudes and values which they in turn passed on to their children. Let me turn to the history of synagogue architecture. During the Napoleonic Wars of the beginning of the 19th century, a victorious France abolished many feudal laws in the countries which it conquered, and it introduced a civil code which extended equal civil rights to all citizens. This included the abolition of the law requiring Jews to live in restricted areas, and which distinguished Jews from other citizens. While there were some progressive measures taken following the demise of the Napoleonic Empire, most European states continued throughout the 19th century to extend fuller civil rights to their Jewish citizens, a process known as emancipation. In consequence, Jews entered professions and trades from which they had been previously excluded. This contributed to a growing and prosperous middle class that mirrored the growth of the European middle classes, a phenomenon linked to the industrialization, urbanization, and modernization which characterized the 19th century. This prosperity and social and political acceptance led many Jewish communities to initiate synagogue projects. Earlier building restrictions, including those restricting buildings within the limits of the ghetto and those which restricted the visibility of the synagogue on the streetscape, were removed. A community could undertake building a synagogue on a preeminent civic site and could erect a facade and structures which clearly showed the function of the building, namely to serve the religious needs of the Jewish community. This in turn sparked a debate concerning the appropriate architectural style for the new projects. One of the favorite choices was the Mooresque, which signaled an Eastern origin or provided a reference to the perceived golden age in Moorish Spain, the homeland of the communities who were the Sephardim. At that time, Jews had lived for the most part under, at that time, Jews had lived for the most part under tolerant Islamic regime and had enjoyed religious liberty. Synagogues built during that period absorbed many Arab influences and reflected Jewish participation in Moorish culture. The integration of this historical reference to a Jewish Oriental past into the architectural project of the 19th century made the identity of the community of worshippers who celebrated their rites within the wall visible at the street level of metropolitan European and North American cities. In contrast, Christian churches being built in this period favored the neo-Gothic or the neoclassical. Many Jewish communities opted to distinguish themselves from their Christian neighbors by employing a different architectural vocabulary. The Gothic or neo-Gothic was thought to be inappropriate because it was thought to be intrinsically Christian. Synagogues of the 19th century and early 20th century were often Byzantine in plan. Greek cross with the arms of the same length, inscribed in a square and capped by a central dome. The structure was often endowed with bulbous domes and domelets, minaret-like towers, and horseshoe arches, borrowing from Arab architecture of mosques and civic buildings. But this synagogue architecture was not a pure architectural style. It borrowed from earlier Romanesque, Gothic, and classical architectural idioms as well. Each community defined its own taste, often in light of national or regional currents or traditions. The style is Spartan homogenous, and in its variance from city to city and from country to country, is more likely to show the autonomy of the Jewish communities which undertook these new synagogues. This variance from synagogue to synagogue reflects the social structure of Jewish communities where decisions are local and communal, as well as the synthetistic, that is, the absorptive nature of Jewish culture in an arena of public architecture. Although this history is well documented, it has become invisible to a large extent. Many of the European synagogues that I use as references, particularly in those countries occupied by the Nazis, were destroyed either on Kristallnacht or sometime thereafter. Many of the North American synagogues, while still extant, are no longer in use as a result of changing demographics and social conditions, as communities move to other neighborhoods, abandon these older synagogues, and constructed new synagogues in other styles. Here in Toronto, Holy Blossom on Donald Street, at the Feast of Young, which was at the center of Toronto's first Jewish neighborhood, and at Jacob on Henley Street, now on the edge of the suburban Chinatown, have had their overtly Jewish signs, such as the modern David, replaced by those of the Greek Orthodox communities which use these buildings as their houses of worship. The affinity of the Greek Orthodox communities for the same architectural features arises from a different historical root, but one which leads ultimately to an Eastern origin as well. Their original use of Jewish synagogues is not immediately visible. One must look hard to find the history of these buildings, for it's not inscribed on the building's facade. But were once the identifying signs that a number of Jewish communities afford from the lexicon of shared signs to be found in the language of architecture, have been exchanged for other signs of visibility by subsequent generations. As such, the signs themselves have lost their immediate recognizability as signs of Jewishness. These synagogues also reveal much about their founding communities. Holy Blossom, Toronto's first synagogue, situated in the St. John's Ward, at the heart of the first center of the Jewish community, was the synagogue of, let us call it, the old Jewish establishment of Toronto, that had assimilated to Anglo society culturally, socially, and commercially. By 1898, it had adopted elements of reform, including services like reading English, mixed seating, organ music, and a choir. Over the next two decades, the Jewish community moved westward around Spadina, coinciding with the influx of immigrants from Eastern Europe who were culturally were very different from the Anglicized or religious. Differences of language, of class, of religious observance separated the new arrivals from the more established Toronto Jews. Members from the village or region would band together to form their own house of worship, as well as other communal organizations. The more modest, but nonetheless beautiful, Anshul Minster, for instance, built by a community which immigrated from the city of Minsk to the heart of Spadina working district, where they set up an Orthodox house of worship. One can also project, though this needs to be confirmed in particular cases, that the men of Holy Blossom are often the employers of the Anshinese congregants. These synagogues are cycles of social history as well. I would like to conclude by making a few observations. The first is that of the variance to be found from synagogue to synagogue, and by extension of the differences between the communities that built these synagogues. That these synagogues are public marks of identity, while sharing some broad general characteristics, are local in nature. No one feature became a universal sign of Jewishness. The second observation is that the architectural idioms employed were not intrinsic to the Jewish communities that used them, but were part of the European cultural legacy, including that part of its history bound up with the history of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Further, while some architectural decisions were made to distinguish Jewish houses of worship from their Christian neighbors, most synagogues bore features which were also to be found in the Christian contemporary architecture that surrounded them. These synagogues are a synthesis of various architectural traditions. Finally, the architectural choices which were made reflect the contingency of science. What was deemed appropriate at that time would not carry the same value at another period of time, and considering the shifts in political and social realities would probably be deemed inappropriate. Signs of Jewishness, as they are in architecture, change with time. The beauty of this architecture lies not only in the legacy of these buildings. These synagogues are the fruit of the labor of small communities. Architecture is a public, secular, and ultimately contingent way of affirming identity, and reveals the negotiations within communities and without with the larger society. It reveals the complexity of history and the richness of its people.
Quite such a prepared talk, and it's going to meander, so we'll meander along with it. I can start by telling you some aspects of my own personal story, some aspects of my own autobiography, but the danger in that is that you'll think you know me. The worst part of that is you'll think you know my work, and we have to be really careful when we start to make linear connections or direct connections between the aspects of my lived life and the work that I do, because the work that I do is always informed by the choices that are made from those origins that might be really autobiographical, but they might also be fictive. The title of the work in this exhibition is called A Truth, A Fiction, A Shabbos Clothes and Feeling an Imposter. And I was struck by a quote in a book that I have read, written by Dorothy Allison. And the book is entitled Two or Three Things I Know for Sure. And I'd like to read the quote. I am a storyteller. I'll work to make you believe me. Throw in some real stuff. Change a few details, add the certainty of outrage. I know the use of fiction in a world of hard truth, the way fiction can be harder as a piece of truth. The story of what happened, or what did not, but should have, that story can become a curtain drawn shut, a piece of insulation, a disguise, a razor, a tool that changes each time it's used. Behind the story I tell is the one that I don't. Behind the story you hear is the one I wish I could make you hear. Two or three things I know for sure, and one is,
I'd rather go naked than wear the coat the world has made for me. Now, this piece that you'll see in the gallery really confuses the autobiography because I'm in it. The photographs of me wearing a paper dress and taking apart that paper dress, wearing nothing underneath, and sewing it into a blanket as I take the pieces apart was part of a performance that I had created about a year ago as part of an event organized by the Quebec Lesbian Network. And this particular version of it brings about certain questions about the stories that we make of our lives, the narratives that we make, and how they are to be understood. But the piece is also inspired, and was inspired, aside from Dorothy Allison, the writing that she's done, by a painting that was done in the early part of the century by an artist by the name of Isabel Kaufman. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that particular painting because I saw it first shown as a slide in the conference that I had organized called Visual Art and Visual Identity. And it was shown in a talk by Norman Quinlash, who is the curator of collections at the Jewish Museum. And there was something that was really very, very poignant and very striking about that painting. And it haunted me. It haunted me for 3 years, and I couldn't quite understand why. I'm not sure I still do, but there's something very evocative in that particular painting. Now, Isidor Kaufman was an artist who lived in Vienna in 1853. He was born in 1853, and he died in 1921. This particular painting called The Friday Evening was done shortly before his death and was left unfinished. And I think maybe part of what I really, what drew me to that painting was the fact that it was unfinished because it left me an open-ended parenthesis for me to insert my own ending to it. So if it was a finished painting, I don't know that I would have necessarily taken such a liberty to connect on it in my version anyway. Now, artists as stylistically and geographically diverse as Paul Gauguin in France or Fritz von Hood in Germany and Isidor Kaufman in Austria often saw escape from the density, commercialism, and moral decay of great urban centers in the late 19th century. The search for their for simplicity and traditionalism led them to the folk society of the nearby countryside. Although formal religious practice was of diminished importance to these artists, the respect for the apparent peace and beauty of these more pious lifestyles drew each to observe his co-religionists. Gauguin was attracted to the Catholicism of the Breton peasants, Fritz von Hood to the fundamentalist Protestants in various parts of Germany, and Kaufman to the Hasidic Judaism in the neighboring Galicia, Hungary, and Poland. Isidor Kaufman was born in Hungary to enlightened parents and showed little early artistic promise. I love that. That's part of my own. I can claim that as part of my artistic own personal story. I love that little early artistic practice. How many of us have heard that? About our own possible careers. Initially, he worked in a factory and then as a bank clerk. But in the evenings, he drew and decorated his room with pictures. He found some benefactors, moved from Budapest to Vienna in 1876, and in time achieved success as a portrait painter of rich Austro-Hungarian Jews. His real fame came as a result of his ventures into the countryside, where he traveled from village to village in Galicia, in Poland, and in Ukraine to paint everyday Jewish life. There he found subjects and ideas. But in Kaufman's pictures, one doesn't see misery or squalor. His Jews are always decked out in their Shabbos best, in their Sabbath best. Their bodies are always washed clean. After all, his prosperous patrons were more interested in colorful and decorated pictures than in sadness or in poverty. In this respect, his works are reminiscent of Oppenheim's German genre art, and the two have been described as practitioners of bourgeois realism. Kaufman's approach was characterized by fine detail and rich color, and recalled the old Dutch style more than the trends that were newly emerging during his lifetime. His figures are refined and bland, a reflection perhaps of his own peaceful life. There's no reason to believe that he personally encountered any anti-Semitism. He was not religiously observant, and it's unclear why he felt compelled to travel through Galicia, Poland, and Ukraine in order to paint the Hasidic life. But his paintings were very popular with his cosmopolitan and wealthy clientele, and the folio print of his work, printed 3 years after his death, was very widely distributed. He won awards, and at the age of 67, he was, when he died, one of the funeral orations eulogized him as no one better has ever solved the mystery that covers the soul of his race. But the artist, he says, was a relatively minor figure. But he was a cultured observer, a good storyteller, tasteful, if not innovative, charming, but not cynical. And this comes from a catalog written about his work. Now, the isolation of the figure in the original painting, and that painting, a reproduction of that painting, is in the binder. Soon we'll be able to see that in the gallery. Really struck me is a table set for Friday night, and the sitter is a lone woman. There are no other chairs around the table. And I always wondered whether he recognized the solitude and the isolation that was painted and that was palatable in the face and in the posture of this woman painted. And I was also very struck by the costume and the clothing. And so in understanding how I was moved by this piece and trying to figure out a way in which I could respond artistically and with the tradition that I follow of performance and photography, I was very struck by the idea of the clothing and replaced her Germanic dress with a paper pattern dress that I sewed. And I'll just read a very small piece from a catalog essay that was put together about clothing called The Discursive Dress, and was an exhibition that was held not too long ago. And the text, the catalog says, the overlapping realms of public and private, connecting individual experience with culturally constructed meanings, offer one way to begin examining the interconnections between the various definitions of clothing. That clothing is at once a cultural symbol and a vehicle of personal expression provides a form to pursue an aesthetic exploration of political issues, bringing together two concepts which until recently have been understood as opposites. So rather than talk about identity, I talk about identifications and the creation of subjectivities, because I think that we look to figures, whether they're artistic figures or cultural figures or figures in our lives, to not only understand our past identifications and the past in which we form our identity, but also how we want to construct ourselves into the future and what forms we use to identify where we want to be creating ourselves to. So, how is this related to the Jewish aspect of my life? Personally, it's in perhaps the details. It's in perhaps the choices that I make about the materials that I use, about what I leave out, and about how what you see is also informed very much by your own stories. And I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you. We could see quite a different focus. I didn't know it was myself. I'm going to open the floor to questions.
There's no mic in Raleigh, so if you want to speak, you can raise your hand, you know, and write it back or whatever works. I have a question I have to ask just about the talk.
I think the question is, where does Jewishness enter? And perhaps the question is a loaded one in the sense that when I did a piece on Agadir, which is about the school desk, and it's about schooling, but it's in a university setting. And I think for me, the answer is really clear in that when I'm teaching or I'm making a student or being involved in the university context, I'm not in my primary identity isn't that of being Jewish. But it is that of being a teacher or of being a student. I think the Buddhist that we've gone mentioned there, were all
question, because whenever you get six people talking about Jewish art, it's inevitable that this question will come up, because it's such a huge part of what we understand Orthodoxy to be about. And here's one part of, that I'll reveal to you. I'm the daughter of an Orthodox rabbi, and so I know very, very well what all of the constraints are about making images and how we understand them to be according to the Orthodox way. And the question is, how do we understand the frames that we create? Who are we talking to? Who are the audiences that we want to reach? And it's not an easy thing. I know that each time I put up a work where I push the boundaries and I ask questions about the nature of what it is that I'm doing as a subversion, I have enormous guilt, right? Because also my parents are really very supportive of my work. And so here my father comes in, he's on the phone. I had a woman sitting in a child in the Servitori Metra. Now, there is also, according to the Jewish Orthodoxy, a prohibition about a Jewish woman giving voice in public space. So, how do you deal with the contradictions? As a feminist, as a Jewish woman, as on and on and on, I can give a list, we can all give the who we are and how we deal with paradox. But I think for me, part of it is precisely to look at the subversion, to look at the limits of how we can understand them to be, and not disrespectfully, but with an understanding that there is place for questions. There has always been place for questions, as long as Orthodoxy isn't understood as...
Continuing from that, I don't have the constraints that Deborah has in terms of my background. I have other constraints. I wasn't brought up in a traditional Jewish home, so I didn't even know what the rules were, the do's and the don'ts. But there are other constraints, and there is always, if you choose to make your work in a way that situates it as perhaps subversive or with that intention, or if not even subversive, if you intend your work to ask questions, then you'll always be bucking some kind of tradition or creating some kind of conflict between what you're trying to say with your work and perhaps the constraints that come out of your own background. So that tension, I think, can sometimes make for interesting work. It raises a lot of questions. And I think that there's no straightforward answer here. But again, it also does allude to the audience. Who are you making this for? Who is your audience? If you're working within an Orthodox Jewish community, then clearly the work that you would do would be very different than if you were doing work at the ATO or that audience or at the power plant or wherever it might be. So I think that considerations of where the work is going to be cited and who is making the work are part of the answer. If there's an answer, that's it.
I think it's very interesting to look at, again, the history of Sindel, and to find within Sindel that date back to 3,000 years the presence of the images within Sindel. And that the interpretation of the prohibition varied from community to community, and that there are commentaries given by the rabbis of the community that
said she said we were everything in her work was somehow related, and so she was kind of upset. And then you did address that a little bit about how you formed by your background and your culture. So I was reading about your work and the deep performance that you did, and you said a very interesting thing. You did a deep performance where you were for 6 hours you were peeling beets, and you made reference to the fact that your grandmother had a very red every case of him peeling beets, but also saying that it started from nothing and that you were just being forced. And what you think is that you pointed out that the deep performance touched on personal life, but did not rest on it. So always you drawing from something that.
For those of you who don't know the Beat performance, this was a piece that I had done, street intervention. A year and a half ago, my home and my workspace for the same building was burned down as an act of arson. And the will to violence is something that I think is the hardest thing for me to overcome. The loss of my work, the loss of my books, the loss of my grandfather's film, Masa, all of that, and you know the personal histories that go along with what happens when you lose your entire life content, especially for an artist who's been working with memory of the life. All of that pales in relationship to the idea that this will to violence can be stronger than any. You know, sometimes stronger if we let it, to anything that we can construct for the good. And I was determined to try and find a way to capture that energy and create from it. So on the 6 month anniversary of the fire, I sat in front of the house that was burned in a white dress, barefoot, and I peeled beets for 6 hours. That's what I did. And of course what happened was the interaction on the street became something that I couldn't possibly understand before I had done it. I just said, I trust this as an image. I trust this as a gesture, and I'll just see what happens. And the generosity of people it was quite amazing. The line between performance and real life and insanity in that case was really thin. And I had a lot of police stopping and asking me if I had a home and where I was living and you know, what's my address, and do I have a phone number. And an elderly woman walked by, and her hands were really full of bags, and she stopped, and in French she said to me, I don't know what it is that you're doing, but let me tell you, I understand you. And no matter how long and how fast you peel those beets, you can go faster than time. And she said, every time that I peel beets in my kitchen, I now remember this. And so that's the beet performance. And the question, of course, is how relevant is the color imagery? How relevant is how we stain ourselves? How do we mark ourselves? How do the things in our lives mark us? One of the things that I couldn't have imagined is that after a few days, while the stain of the beet still rests, only it oxidizes and my hands actually look burnt. And I couldn't have known that in advance. And so there are strange ways in which pieces take us places when we are open enough to listen to where they want to go. But my grandmother's hands were definitely something that came to mind each time we drove from New York. It was my grandmother who spoke Russian and Yiddish, and that's about it. And all she did was peel beets to make borscht every paper. And another thing that came to mind was a beautiful essay that was written by Irina Kreskich, a poet, lesbian activist from New York, who wrote a piece about how borscht, I wish I remembered the title, it's such a great title, how the making of borscht was an act of trying to understand the challenges of tradition with respect to making the ones where we feel comfortable, where we can feel proud.
and I was really quite touched by the essay, and I think that was most important to me. Your piece in the festival for the reviewing place is going to tell us that identity. And much of it was about identity, perception, history, and memory. Yet this piece isn't specifically about these concepts. It's very universal, and yet at the same time very personal. So in your history, your background,
my case, I don't have specifics of cultural or religiously specific markers and memories that Devora has. So my work is about searching for what that identity is. And it's a fragmented identity, and it's a very, there was an uprooting in my life. But, you know, for me what's interesting is that the idea of exile means that you've got to be exiled from somewhere, or learning a new language means that there's a language that you lost to learn a new one. I don't remember what language I had. I had several languages, none of which I was fluent in because I was so young. And I don't have a country of origin that is strong enough in my memory because I left it so long. And most of my background had to do with this desire to assimilate and to erase difference. But you can't erase difference. So half my life I was trying to erase difference, and half my life, I mean, it's not so neatly divided, but another part of my life has been spent trying to reclaim, or not even reclaim, well, in some ways, reclaiming an identity that I didn't know I had in terms of my Jewishness, and just trying to figure out what my origins were. So I think that a lot of my work that isn't specifically Jewish, I don't have those rituals to draw on like Devora, I don't have a memory of places of worship other than churches, actually. That's what I have in my background. But I don't have kind of touchstones of places that I feel I can claim as mine. So the idea of wandering, the idea of searching for identity, the idea of questioning what that identity consists of, what is it that makes your identity, or the other word that Devora uses, subjectivity. It's another way of coming at some of the same issues around identity and memory and history. Those issues circulate in my work all the time, and my work is a kind of searching. So I suppose it, as a kind of long answer to your question and your comment, it's really about that search, about that moving around, collecting postcards, collecting fragments of memories, even if they're not my own, they're somebody's, that make a life, that make a sense of who we are as individuals, and that make us, give us a sense of who we are as part of a large community. And for me, that's an ongoing search that's an ongoing search. That's about, you know, all I can say.
Thank you. And
you said
that in the second comment, you said you wanted to just remember when you were having a conversation and you talked about Stagman. And you said, this relates exactly, quote of yours, what happens when you get that intersection of public and private, and what happens when you're living through history? You don't know. You don't have a history. You have liberal Stagman's history. That's all you know, is your experience. And so that's my comment, is that the Stagman's history is definitely many of your work.
may add, but that those are the fragments that you have to determine whether they're fact or fiction. I know a bit of both, perhaps, because the way we reconstruct history, whether it's our personal or a larger political and cultural one, is in a very fragmented way, and do we believe newspaper headlines? Do we believe the reports on that we see on television and read in newspapers? How is history constructed? How is that symbolic of the way our own personal histories are constructed? The fact that each member of the family has such a totally different version of what happened at any given time. And I find that fascinating, actually. I find that very interesting. And that's the stuff that I work with when I do my own work.
Thank you. This is also that Bora was addressing in your own story, not only from the outside, but in your own story, what facts and fiction and what we tell. And
the whole discussion around memory and history, and this is something I alluded to when I was talking about the different forms. Most of my work over the last 8 years, 9 years, has been about memorial markers and memorializations of private and public events. But I was very curious about the way that you make reference to the markers that I do have, as if somehow that has a value of being privileged or non-privileged, and I'm trying to understand whether or not I hear you say that, or whether or not it is actually something that you're saying because of out of loss. Because I think part of what I have to come to terms with about why I've been working with memory and history is because, although yes, on a certain level there are certain things that are very given in terms of the ritual, in terms of the understanding of where the cultural specificity comes from, there are also huge number of slippages that happen because of other things that I also experienced as a child that put into direct conflict a whole series of understandings about what does it mean to have lived all these Jewish and Orthodox rituals and forms of behavior, including severe abuse from Orthodox men. And so my claiming and my dealing with questions of fragmentation are precisely rooted in those feelings that you're saying that you don't have. And so we end up with that same sense of absence or lack or loss, but in very different places.
Yes, in fact, it's interesting that you mention that, because that was my comment while you were speaking to Deborah, and that is that all three of us, coming from very different backgrounds to some extent and approaching our work in different ways, that all three of us have a very strong sense of loss and mourning in our work. So to get back to that question of artist is Jew, Jew is artist, and the intersection of biography and art practice, I mean, I don't know how you get to that point where here we are, the three of us are sitting here, and we're all talking in one form or another about loss, about memory, about history. And that sense of loss particularly seems very strong. I don't totally understand that.
But I would not want to romanticize it, and I think part of the way to get around that is to look at it as a political issue. I think part of the way to get around the nostalgia of memory is to talk about history. I mean, I think that there's a danger in slipping into a nostalgia or a...
Because if you take nostalgia and leave your memories and ideas in nostalgia, then you don't question. You take that as the received history or the received ideas about what anything is about. You know, the same kind of nostalgia that you have around Mother's Day or Father's Day, that sort of thing. Then if you accept that nostalgia, then where is the questioning? Where is the political aspect? How do you understand?
I'll make a claim for nostalgia. I think that an indulgence now, I admit it's to the indulgence, and I think you're right in wanting to construct so much has passed. And I, as I said in my talk, what I did was that not knowing my where my grandparents came from or where my great grandparents came from, looking through the social history, I have discovered a land, but it's not, I don't think it's a mythic land. I think that the history that I've uncovered is full of political conflicts, economic conflicts, social conflicts, religious conflicts. That don't get papered over. But I do think that, you know, the nostalgia that does begin, and it's interesting to then look through the 19th century and look at where we are in the 20th
century. I think you made a good point, actually, and I don't think nostalgia may be the word to characterize what we're talking about. Perhaps it's more a sentimentality that I am objecting to, because I think that the idea of loss includes the idea of nostalgia. If you have a sense of loss, it means that you're nostalgic for what you've lost, right? So I think that there is a distinction here that is more than just a fine distinction. To lose something means either that you probably had it in some form at one point, and that there is a kind of fall from grace,
or you think you should have had it.
Or you think you should have had it. That
I was almost there, you were almost up to it. Good question.
They are contradictory, and they both feed into the work. I mean, contradiction sometimes becomes part of the work or part of what you're trying to figure out by doing the work. I think you're right. There is that contradiction in there. And I personally struggle with it all the time. I mean, I said that in my talk about, can you be too Jewish, not Jewish enough? And do Jewish artists automatically make Jewish art? Do non-Jewish artists make Jewish art? I mean, there are a lot of contradictions and paradoxes in there. I find labels very problematic and very difficult, because of Deborah implied, or didn't imply, said, there is a danger that you, the viewers, stop there. And I think that for me, my own work, I'm interested in involving the viewer, so that the viewer is drawn in to ask some of the questions that I'm asking, so that they too are participating with me in this process of trying to figure out what identity is about, what history and memory constitute, and by involving them somehow as an integral and important part of the process, it's one strategy, my strategy, of trying to get other people connected to this dialogue.
My answer is to be contrary. Sometimes we always know something that's contrary rather than sort of each other. I don't think that identifications and identity are contradictory at all, are at conflict with each other. I think when you start to look at the difference of why, for example, I work specifically with issues of memory, I think one is rooted in the past and the other is rooted in the future. And I think that we make use of our past in the present to understand where we want to go to the future. I mean, this is not my thinking, this is, you know, just a zillion times by different people. I mean, what are the uses of memory so that we can identify ourselves into the future? And so identifications and identity, I don't see are as being two contradictory elements. Yes, they're complex. I mean, the chaos of identity formation is definitely there, but I think it's very much about seeing whether or not we're looking to the past in terms of the constructions that we know, or we're looking towards the future of where we want to go, in which case we'll look to identification to others, or shedding the ones that we know in order to reveal new places. So I think it's part of a continuum that is precisely rooted in the whole question of memory and history.
I think I'd throw in another term in that, in the sense of that I'm living in modern and postmodern terms, and in some ways that they are contradictory in the sense that I think that maybe it's unfair to kind of encapsulate my life as a paradigm of modernism where identity is erased, and then postmodernism where you kind of rebuild your identity. That's the idea of the postmodern period of being a period where people explore their identity. There's a skepticism of the modernist who looks at the project and says, it can really be authentic stuff.
Thank you. If there's no more questions, yes.
Come to our course. We'll explore this. Lord JCC, this fall.
Thank you.
We will explore these questions.
Do we need a Jewish Easter? Why?
A singular Jewish aesthetic is what we need?
Am I trying to obscure the aesthetic with Mikowski's painting as my point of reference? I don't think so. But I think there's an aspect of comfort. I mean, there's an aspect of knowing home. And I think as much as I personally try to subvert that sometimes or undermine it, I don't know that that's an aesthetic. I think it's more a question of having something as a mirror that we can understand ourselves through. But I would hate to think that there is a singular Jewish aesthetic.
I think the answer that I would give in reviewing the talk that I gave about the synagogue architecture, there are a number of synagogues, is that the aesthetic was constructed. And it was very much time-based. And I would say that that's probably true of every period and every region in which some defines Jewish art in synthetic construction. So it's not kind of a universal Jewish aesthetic, but one that's regional and local and strategic.
And
did you
class and
did you
do and a whole bunch of things?
A Jewish aesthetic, or is the New York and a particular class, education, background? I mean, where are those lines? I mean, I think that there's so many. First of all, the history of Judaism is so tied to whatever nation Jews were a part of that has got to influence a Jewish aesthetic, to think that there might be something isolated from the rest of the communities that they participated in, even though they were ghettoized, they still participated in different ways, I think is unrealistic. So I can't imagine that there is a so-called, I mean, if you're implying that there might be, well, is there a pure Jewish aesthetic? Simon Greenberg is Jewish and had a profound influence on the tenets of modernism, to which we all, in some way or other, adhere or have reacted against. I mean, it's all part of our background in training and aesthetic. Does that make it the Jewish aesthetic? Is that the label that you know we would give that? I don't know. I personally don't think so. I think it's much broader than that and more varied, as my two co-panelists have implied.
Thank you. I think we'll wind up now, and I want to thank the panelists. As the moderator, when organizing the panel, there exists a great deal of unknowns and surprises. And although I posed some questions to the panel beforehand, I did not know what they would come up with, and they have presented provocative, intelligent, insightful views and ways of thinking their identity, memory, culture, how they approach their art, and I so thank you very much, and thank you to the audience for enabling us to present to you. To Sybil Goldstein for all the work she's done and for allowing the opportunity to have this panel.